Part 6. The Necessary Passion. Chapter 1. The way into the Saint-Lazare prison was through a 12-foot gate in an iron fence, across a strip of cobbled yard, through a second gate in a second fence, and under a tunnel of naked stone formed by the 4-foot-thick walls of the building, and so into a corridor, of which a large vaulted room opened to the right, the warder's room. The air in the corridor and the warder's room was damp, with a sweet, musty odour. Windowless, the room was as silent as a wine cellar or a cave. Yet a queer, disagreeable rumour, just beneath the range of hearing, suggested that, behind the further walls and doors, the place was not silent, not empty, but crammed full, jammed, swarming. Luisa Paludeska kept her head high as she and the official who accompanied her waited in the warder's rooms for the prison clerk. She held her silk skirts to keep them from the moist, filthy floor. She did not look about her, did not speak. This was her hour of victory. She had worked for it for 26 months. Two clerks hurried in, wiping their mouths from lunch, and then immediately a tall, fat man in the uniform of a lieutenant of the Polana militia. The official with Luisa opened his mouth to speak, but she beat him to it, saying in a clear voice the words that she had earned the right to say. "Lieutenant, Mr. Konevin brings you an order from the High Court, signed by the Prime Minister, countermanding the sentence of the prisoner Itare Sorde." The big man put out his hand for the paper which Luisa's companion offered him. "How do, Mr. Konevin," he muttered, staring at Luisa. "Yes, indeed, your servant, miss." "Baroness Paludeska, Lieutenant Glay," Konevin muttered. Muttering seemed to be the natural form of speech here. "You'll find it all in order, Glay. Immediate release. See there." They bent their heads over the document and muttered lower. The lieutenant held the paper away from his enormous body, as if afraid it would scorch him. "Yes, yes, sir," Laren say. "Look up Sorde, Itale. Entered December the 27th. Both clerks raised their heads. On entering the room, they'd gone one to a table, the other to a desk, and sat down, without speaking and scarcely glancing at Konevin and Luisa. The one at the table had a head that grew straight out of his shoulders, with a warty grey face. The one at the desk was thin and wiry, with long, lank hair, and a mouth like a razor cut. "Sorde," he said, and the name spoken aloud was startling in this muttering, oppressive silence. "Sorde's dead."
"Dead?
When?" "Last week. End of the week." "I see. We're having the epidemic, you know," the lieutenant informed Konevin and Luisa. "Worse than usual this year. Look up the entry, Larence. White ledger. Specially recommended prisoner," the necklace clerk mumbled in a deep bass. "Get the burial list for February, Larence. Pleased to sit down, Baroness. We're pleased to sit down." The huge lieutenant brought up a chair for her and dusted it with his sleeve. Luisa did not sit down. She feared to move at all. Her ears sang a shrill hum. The lank-haired clerk argued. The necklace one mumbled. The lieutenant muttered. Konevin put in an exasperated remark. She heard nothing they said, only their grotesque voices, frogs on the marshes of hell. "Please to sit down, Baroness." "It may take some time, Baroness," Konevin said. She gave in and sat down, letting her silken skirt drag on the floor. Summoning up all her self-control, she said very softly to Konevin, who stood beside her, "Is he dead, then?"
"Apparently not, Baroness," Konevin replied.
Ears here were turned to whispers. The lank-haired clerk shouted reproachfully as if the others had all been in the wrong. "On the sick list, not the death list." And the necklace one droned, "Specially recommended." Louisa shuddered all over and put her hands to her cheeks. The blood, which had dropped sickeningly from her head, was returning in a hot wave, dizzying her. She sat perfectly still until she knew she could trust herself not to faint, and then said in an even voice, smiling a little, to Konevin, "I wonder that a man can stay alive 2 years in this place."
"Much longer than that, Baroness," the official answered stiffly.
It made it clear, when she met him at the office of the governor, that he did not like the business she was on. Since entering the prison, he had been completely rigid, wearing a fixed look of distaste and exasperation on his round, ruddy face.
"What is the epidemic?"
"Prison fever, I suppose," Konevin answered, and drew a short breath. He was afraid of infection, Louisa realized, and the thought gave her pleasure.
"He has been ill, then. Are they going to release him?"
Yes, Baroness. Look here, Clay, I can't spend the afternoon here. Tell them to get on with it."
"In a minute, Mr. Konevin, in a minute," the huge man answered, cringing yet unmoved. This was his domain, not Konevin's, and both knew it. The lank-haired clerk was writing, his pen scraping with a loud, hard sound like his voice. The lieutenant went to the table, shifted papers about, muttered the necklace clerk. There was no clock. Louisa sat turning a ring on her finger, pressing her right hand hard with her left, staring at the watery gleam that ran on the grey silk of her skirt. She could barely hold still. She could not endure to wait any longer. But still, the unmarked minutes went by and went by. And there was no telling if the time was long or short, or if it was passing at all. There was a noise out in the corridor, and a guard in militia uniform came in with a tall, bald man in his 60s. They stopped just inside the doorway. The bald man stood stooped over, staring vaguely. He was wearing shapeless grey trousers and an old coat too large for him, and was barefoot. Realizing that he was a prisoner, Louisa looked hastily away from him.
"Sorte Itale," the lieutenant was saying, and the guard was also saying the name. "Sorte, specially recommended." Sick with disgust and anger, Louisa sat still and said, "This is not the man. Will you act on this order of release, lieutenant, or must I come here with the governor of the prison?"
"Not the man?
What ward?"
"Nivek."
"Sick ward," the militiaman said. "This is him."
"Extraordinary inefficiency," Konevin said. And the lieutenant, suddenly angry and frightening in his anger, swung his great bulk and height towards the militiaman.
"Who is this? Take him back," he said.
while the militiaman repeated stolidly, "This is him." The prisoner stood as if indifferent, his empty gaze crossing Louisa's. He raised his hands to rub his eyes, and with terror, she recognized the gesture. "It is him. It's him," she said in a whisper to Konevin. Again, all the others heard her whisper. The lieutenant drew himself up, righteous and vindicated, and the militiaman stepped back, and the clerks muttered. Konevin looked at her coldly. She sat still. It was Konevin who went up to the prisoner, although not close to him, and said in a stifled and embarrassed tone, "Sode, Mr. Sode." The man stood patiently, unresponding. "We're here with your release, Mr. Sode. Your sentence is countermanded by the High Court. Do you understand?" He came back to Louisa. "The man's very sick," he said with nervous distaste. "I have no idea what you can do. An impossible situation. Are you quite certain that you..." "Will you have them finish whatever formalities are necessary, please?" She did not look at the prisoner. One of our officials is bringing the prisoner's possessions, Baroness," the lieutenant explained, officious and self-confident now, looming over her. "All his belongings when arrest was affected. They've been in confiscation, you see, Baroness. Nobody has disturbed them." "Better send for the blacksmith," the lank-haired clerk said, and the necklace one snarled. "Don't need the smith. He's been in the sick wards." And the lieutenant muttered, "Has he a fetter, Nivek?" And the militiaman answered, "No." While Konevin walked away down the room, clicking his tongue in a fit of impatience and disgust. And finally, a guard came in with a valise, a string-tied bundle of clothing, and a small parcel wrapped in paper. The lieutenant opened the parcel and spread out its contents on the table with his enormous white hands. A silver watch and chain, a pair of cufflinks, some copper change, a penknife. "The gentleman's jewelry and all, you see, Baroness. Nothing has been touched," he said. The valise and the bundle were spotted with a soft, bluish mould. "Can we go now?" Louisa said. But there were still papers to be prepared. The necklace clerk was writing something that must be written before they could go. "You can't put the man in your cab, Baroness," Konevin said, in a low voice as they stood at the desk. "The state is in." "What do you suggest I do instead?" Louisa demanded. And, in reaction to Konevin's pusillanimity, she brought herself to go up to the man in grey and speak to him. She said his name and did not know what else to say. He did not seem to look directly at her, nor did he answer directly. But after a while he spoke in a thin, hoarse voice. "May I sit down?" His body and clothing stank of sweat and sickness. The coat he wore had been red or plum-coloured, but was black with dirt. She could not touch him. She pointed to the wooden chair. "Yes, sit down." He did not move. Once he rubbed his hand hard over his face, in that gesture terribly familiar to her, and then stood again, patient, blinking his swollen eyes. "The fever, you know, Baroness," the lieutenant was saying, as he held out a set of folded papers to her. "Makes him dull. No doubt he'll be better soon. This here is the order of release. This is his passport, and Mr. Carnavian will explain. The guard will take his things out for you. An honour to be of service to you, Baroness. The guard who had brought Itali in was gone, and Carnavian would not help her. The clerks and the lieutenant were watching, malevolent. She had to take Itali's arm to make him move, to make him come with her, out of the warder's room, under the stone arch. He shuffled, lame and unsteady. When they came out onto the cobbled yard, into the clear, cold sunshine of a day of March, he stopped and put his hands up over his eyes in pain. "Come on. Come with me," she coaxed him. The guards at the prison entry, the guard at the outer gate, stood watching, curious and without sympathy. What she was doing was wrong, was against what they wanted, what they stood for, what they stood there for, keeping the gates locked and the doors shut. What she had imagined and anticipated 1,000 times as the moment of triumph was humiliating and grotesque. The driver of the cab that she'd kept waiting stared at the shambling man with her and said, "Not inside." And she had to give him 10 kroner before he would let Itali ride inside the cab. Then she must climb into that cramped box with him and sit beside him, in uncontrollable aversion from and fear of his misery, his illness, his abjectness. He sat crouching, the hairless head nodding when the cab jolted, the hand lying lax on his thighs, very large and dead white, like the hands of the lieutenant in the warder's room. Carnavian, who rode with the driver, proved most serviceable when they reached the hotel. She had planned to spend the night at the hotel, and then take Itali on in her carriage to her Sovena estate, 50 miles to the north. The first part of that plan was dropped without discussion. Carnavian found her horses and a landaulette and got the hotel people to make up a bed in Louisa's carriage. When this was done, it was late afternoon. Itali, in her carriage, and she and the landaulette, with her maid, set off, one behind the other, down the steep streets of Rakava, out of the cold north gate, past the factories, on to the long downslope of the high road north. Roads were bad after the March rains. The Ras was in flood, and they had to go 30 miles out of their way to Faranoy, to cross at the bridge, and 30 miles back to the north road. So there were 3 nights and 2 days getting to their destination. The sick man continued most of the time in the same lassitude and indifference, asleep or in stupor. But when they arrived in the early morning, he was feverish and could not walk at all. Louisa's letter to the housekeeper had suffered the usual mail delay. So the house was half ready and half in cold disorder. It was raining. Louisa had the sick man put to bed and sent for the doctor. But before he arrived, she went to bed herself, worn out, and slept for 20 hours. The doctor, a sour man of the veterinary barber physician breed, said the patient was suffering a relapse brought on by the cold and discomfort of the journey. Cold and discomfort, Louisa repeated sarcastically, thinking of the walls of St. Lazar. But she made no explanations to the doctor, having learned already, from the guards at the prison gate, from the cab driver, from her maid, from her own feelings, not to mention jail. If the doctor knew, or could admit that he knew, where his patient had spent the last 2 years, he would consider both the man and the woman whose house he was in with contempt. He would take her money, of course, and provide his services, but he would hold himself superior. Good men do not get put in jail. Why was it like this? Why was all her triumph turned to shame and mere wretched inconvenience? He lay there sick and stupid day after day. He had never even clearly recognized her, never said her name. He was utterly out of reach, his mind gone. She did not dare ask the doctor if that blank stupor was caused by the disease or not, if it might lessen, if the disease were cured, what hope of recovery there was. She looked into the sick room once a day. She was unwilling to admit to herself that the sight of Itali now frightened and disgusted her. The bald head, shaved for lice, the doctor said. The blank look, the bony, yellowish body, restless and yet slack. If she must look at that sick body, it would take the place of the remembered lover, the young man in his strength. Those few nights, those few hours that she'd held to be the chief treasure of her life, the only time she'd ever touched another person, would be tainted, degraded, with the prison taint, the smell of sickness and mortality. She would have nothing left at all. She must cling to the past and to the future when he would be himself again. But this was the future that she had dreamed of for so long. Itali freed. The two of them here in the lonely house in the returning spring. It went on raining. They could not keep the house warm. The old housekeeper was ill and querulous. The steward of the estate came daily with questions she could not answer intelligently, and justifications for loans, purchases, and sales he had made, which she knew nothing about. The doctor came and went, silent and sour, with his bottle of fat black leeches. She rode out daily on one of the stiff-kneed old horses. There had been no hunters or riders to keep up the stables for many years. The peasant tenants went about their business, indifferent to the presence or absence of the landowner. She knew no one any longer in the town, 6 miles away, where her grandfather had laid the foundations of his fortune, speculating on wartime food prices, and had been a great man. Bored and wretchedly lonely, Louisa felt as she had when she was a child here, shoved aside, forgotten. Yet it was she who had isolated herself, telling no one her plans, so that she and Itali could be alone for once. She wrote to Enrique in Vienna that he must take his leave early and come spend it at the estate. "I must have you here," she wrote. "I am at my wit's end." Never had the trials and setbacks, the affronts and efforts of her long siege on the Krasnoy government, so exhausted and defeated her as had these 2 weeks since she went with the order of release to Saint-Lazare. She knew now how much she'd enjoyed that siege, the strategies and flatteries, the slow building up of her influence, the outwitting of the malicious and outpacing of the stupid. She had, always with the single goal, though she might not speak or even think about it for days or weeks, made herself a considerable figure in the politics of the capital. She had done small and great favours for men and women less astute than herself. She had got her brother his diplomatic post in Vienna. She had become a friend of the Grand Duchess, and a friend of the rabble-rousing deputy, Stefan Aragon. Prime Minister Cornelius came to our house on Roche Street for conversation with clever and discreet people. The new Minister of Finance, Raske Nesca of Val Altesma, had proposed marriage to her as a speculation that would profit them both. The Krasnoy Intelligencer was full of gossip about her, but no one made a slander, personal or political, stick to her name. She had used all her gifts, used them gallantly, and made a complete, recognized conquest of her aim. She had conquered. And the conquest, won by that brave career through the rooms and offices of the powerful, was this. The sight of the sick man, the memory of the sight of him, tormented her. Why must she be punished? Had she not worked to set him free? Had she not succeeded? What was freedom then? This desolation. The doctor had supplied a woman from town to look after Itali. One night, when this nurse was downstairs eating her dinner, Louisa went into the sick room, driven by an angry restlessness. There was no light, but that of a bright fire. She thought the sick man was asleep, but as she came nearer the bed, he spoke. "Who is there?" "I am," she said. "Louisa, do you know me?" She went up close to him and spoke aloud, impatient and challenging. She could not see his face. He answered. His voice was weak but natural, his own voice. "I can't remember," he said. "Where's Amadei?" She went cold, and the breath stuck in her throat. "He is not here," she whispered at last. The sick man paid no attention. He turned his head a little. The red firelight shone on the dry curve of his cheek. He lay there, gazing straight ahead. Louisa went to a chair at the foot of the bed and sat down. She was shaky now, and soon stood up cautiously to leave the room. As she did so, he gave a long sigh and murmured something, then spoke two words clearly. "The snow," and lay silent again. She hurried out of the room, went to her own room, and stood at the window and looked out over the front garden. Between running clouds, the full moon shone and faded. She saw the road, a straight, light streak between the dark fields, leading away from the front gate. When she was a child, she had seen that road, on which adults, visitors, her parents, came and went, as freedom. To be hers, her way, when the time came. She would be free to go, to come as she liked, dependent upon no one. She went on that road now as she liked. She had her freedom. The word had lost its meaning, like the word love. Had she not loved Itali, and he her? But she did not know who he was. She had worked to free a man, and he was not that man who lay sick in the room in this house. What did it mean, that they had been lovers? What had she been to him? He did not know her. He had not said her name. He had asked for a dead man, and he had said, "The snow." The memories, accretions, complexities, affections, anxieties, the trivial and immense world, of which she had for a while been one element. She could hear fragments of that if she wanted to listen to his mind wandering in fever. But then, where was she? Astray in a strange place. The world as Itali knew it, his world, of which she was not and had never been the center. To accept the limitless richness, the independence of being not her own, was to lose herself. She could not do it. She had never been able to do it. But those few times, those hours, which she now denied. What was the good of that? Of love, so-called. Of hands and bodies touching and meeting. All that. When this was the truth, this miserable isolation of the dying body, the sick animal. She dreamed that night that she was wandering in the streets of a town she'd never seen, a town amongst the mountains, and the streets were packed snow. She could not find the place where she was to go, where the pack horse was stabled. The next day, late in the afternoon, a caller was announced as she came in from a long ride. Mr. Sode. She stared for a moment in pure bewilderment, almost panic, collecting her wits only when she saw the man waiting for her in the drawing-room. A middle-aged, provincial gentleman in black. She came forward on guard. "I am Luisa Paludesca." The man bowed. "Emmanuel Sorde, Baroness." "Itali's father?" "His uncle. His father's health doesn't permit him to travel at present. I am sorry to intrude myself on you, Baroness. May I see Itali?" She had not written to Itali's family, nor had she notified any of his friends in Krasnoy of anything beyond the fact of his release from prison. They had written to the family in the Montana, and this man had travelled across the country simply on the chance that Itali was here. If he had not been here, he would have found him wherever he was. He did not ask why she had not written. He did not care. He was simply resolute. He was going to see Itali. She took him upstairs at once. She left him in the sick room and went to her room to change in a dry, bitter mood. How long would it go on? Instead of love and secrecy, she'd got sickness and loneliness. Instead of triumph, shame. Instead of Itali, his uncle for company. It was a bad joke. Had she been wrong to look forward to Itali's release as happiness for her as well as for him? If she had not been seeking that happiness, how could she have carried on for 2 years and done all she had done to win his freedom? Where did the fault, the error, lie? The uncle's presence at dinner relieved her at least from the endless brooding over such questions. He was tired and hungry, and preoccupied entirely with his nephew. His manner was stiff and wary, but essentially indifferent. She was not what interested him. She began to feel at ease with him. When they spoke of Itali's illness, she asked Emmanuel Sorde a question she never brought herself to ask the doctor. "Even when his fever is down, he doesn't seem to notice things." She did not explain what it was she feared, but Sorde appeared to understand her, replying, "It's the disease, I believe, Baroness. It's what the word typhus means. A stupor. It passes. What does your physician say?" She shook her head. "He won't tell me even whether Itali is worse or better." "The woman says his fever has been down the last 2 days." She had not known that. She sat silent over her scarcely touched plate while Sordi ate. "Baroness," he said rather abruptly, "I saw Mr. Brelavay as I came through Krasnoy. He told me what your modesty prevented your writing us. We are so deeply in your debt that it is presumption in me to speak of it." She was taken aback. She answered without forethought, "I am not modest, Mr. Sordi. I act in my own interest. Itali was my friend. That friend was taken from me. I acted to get him back. That's all." Surprising her again, the provincial lawyer simply smiled and raised his glass with a slight formal bow of the head. He was, she realized, like Itali, formidable. "All I ask," she said, "is to see Itali as he was." "That we will not see, Baroness."
"But he is recovering."
"I hope so. I dare think so, having seen him, changed as he is. But I do not hope ever to see him as he was." He finished eating, laid down his fork quietly across the plate, country style. He was hateful in his provincial, middle-aged self-assurance. He did not care for her. He did not care what she lost. He was old, and like all the old, he did not care for the future, did not believe in it. But if he was right, if Itari was changed, would not be the same again, what future was she looking for? Again, the figure of the warder's room, pitiful and repulsive, stood between her and the handsome, kindly boy who had been her lover. As if the fever had burnt up all that image, like paper, like a bit of paper money in a fire. What was left? The old man, the uncle, was right. They were always right. There was nothing left of Itali, but that man upstairs, whom she did not know, whom she did not want to look at or be near.